Welcome to a special Christmas season edition of Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm joined in this edition by Tom Eblin, host of our series on Kentucky's deep bench of novelists, poets, historians, and journalists. We'd like to invite you to take in as much of this hour as your time allows. We have lots of stories to share with you. So, under our tree, all wrapped up and ready to open, a collection of stories of Christmas experiences in Kentucky. They are drawn from the pages of the seasonal anthologies A Kentucky Christmas, edited by George Ella Lyon, and Kentucky's 12 Days of Christmas, published by Kentucky Monthly Magazine. Plus, how the celebration of Christmas has meant very different things depending on whether you're a famous network television reporter or a laid-off Appalachian coal miner. And what happened after a young son of a Louisville author wondered why there are so few black people in Christmas books? We begin deep in an eastern Kentucky hollow. Among the stories contained in A Kentucky Christmas, a collection of holiday stories edited by George Ella Lyon and published by the University Press of Kentucky, is When She Came to Mercy. It's a story by award-winning Kentucky novelist and educator Silas House. Welcome, Silas.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Silas, this is a beautiful story, and I'd like to begin with the scene and the way you describe winter in the mountains of eastern Kentucky. Was that drawn from your own recollection of what that was like?
Well, it wasn't recollection so much as I was just describing where I lived. I lived on Slate Ridge, in the little town of Lilly in Laurel County. And when I got the idea for the story, I went out in the woods, you know, and walked around and climbed the hill and just experienced it the way that they would have been experiencing. I try to do that as much as I can. I think that it makes sense of place so much more vivid if you're able to really immerse yourself in it.
There are two characters in this story. Tell us about them.
Well, first of all, the story is set at Christmas 1899. And so some of the story revolves around the fact that there was quite a bit of superstition around the turn of the century and into 1900, into the 20th century, the same way that we sort of reacted to going into the 21st century. And so Mercy is an older lady who's living by herself up in a holler. And her only living child lives pretty far away. But she's very self-reliant, and she's really determined to remain there in that isolated place as long as she can. And one day she goes out to get some coal, and she sees a girl, a young woman, up on the mountain coming down towards her. And so then she discovers that Susanna has been turned out by her parents, particularly her father, because she's gotten pregnant. And I think she's around 16 or 17. And so she's just sort of, you know, she's homeless and doesn't know what to do except to walk, and she's just about numb and happens to stumble upon Mercy.
And so Mercy discovers that this girl's name is Susanna, and that really meant something to her. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that it gives the story a bit of a magical realism feel to some degree. It's revealed that Mercy had a child who has died, who was also named Susanna, and she hasn't said that name aloud since her daughter died. And so right away, she's taken by this young woman, not only, you know, by the situation she's in and the fact that she needs help, but also that she has her dead daughter's name. And so she's just sort of instantly endeared to her on a few levels.
I want to inject just a question here that doesn't really carry along the story, but I'm sure our listeners are curious too, Silas. When you're thinking about these stories, as you're developing these stories, the detail that you just gave us is so interesting. Where does that come from?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I laugh because I don't know, you know, and I think that the best writing is when you don't really know where it comes from. It's, you know, it's the organic writing that makes for the best parts of the story. And that I tend to like more because I don't feel responsible for it. You know, I just think, once you open yourself up to the imagination, you know, things just are able to layer themselves in really interesting ways. So I don't know where that came from, but I know that it came just as I was writing the story. You know, it just lit inside the story.
So the gears begin to turn and you just go with them.
Yeah, for me, it's all about creating the character. You know, and once I start to create a character like Mercy, I start to think about what her secret is, what her trouble is, you know, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so things just present themselves in those layers that make us complex beings happen.
Okay, back to the story here. Mercy is, she invites this girl to stay with her. And the next day, they go together out on the mountain to gather greenery for Christmas. And something happened while they were out there. Tell us about that.
Well, Mercy stumbles and, you know, I think she's starting to realize that her age is really catching up with her. She feels pretty feeble, although she's never going to admit that. But I think it's a moment of her realizing her own mortality and sort of thinking about the dangers of living alone, for someone her age and her shape. But Susanna, you know, is willing to stay there with her as long as she needs her to. And it's this moment that sort of the story comes full circle, because in the beginning, Susanna needs Mercy's help. And by the end, Mercy realizes that she could use Susanna's help. So I think it's a really endearing moment that we come to care for both of the characters, because we've been able to see both their vulnerabilities, you know.
Well, we won't spoil the ending for our listeners, but I'm wondering is there a message that comes through in this story? Any particular thing that you are saying?
Well, I wrote this story for a Kentucky Christmas. When Georgella asked me for something, I didn't have anything already written, and so I just decided I would write something. So I was writing it very much with Christmas in mind, and I was thinking about, you know, as corny as it sounds, I guess, what Christmas means to me is something that, you know, we hear in songs and things like that. But for me, I think that it made sense to write a story about that, really, what we should be doing always, not just at Christmas. But I think Christmas makes us think about this more, is that we should be helping each other, that we should be trying to be the best people we can be. That kindness is the main thing that matters. And I do think that people have that in mind at Christmas time, that they want to be kinder people. They want to be more patient. You know, there's something about the season that makes us want to be better people. And if we could just carry that through the whole year, the world would be a really different place. But that's what it means to me. You have these two people who need help, and they help each other.
Well, you convey that well, because that's exactly how it left me, and I really enjoyed this story. It's Kentucky novelist Silas House, author of the short story When She Came to Mercy, and it's among the dozens from Kentucky's finest writers that fill the pages of A Kentucky Christmas, edited by George Ella Lyon and published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thank you, Silas.
Thank you, Tom. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Same to you. This time of year is joyful for many, difficult for many others. And sometimes it's a little bit of both, as we're about to hear in Tom Eblin's first contribution to this hour about Christmas in Kentucky.
I'm speaking today with Crystal Wilkinson, Kentucky's current poet laureate. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, Crystal is an award-winning novelist and short story writer and associate professor at the University of Kentucky. The book of Kentucky Christmas includes her poem, The Visit. Crystal, could you read that poem for us?
Certainly. The Visit. Mama, it was like Christmas on Sundays when you came to the creek. Your arms always heavy with dolls, tea sets, chocolate-covered cherries, or candy corn. Your eyes searching my face for a daughter's smile, scanning me with a mother's familiarity to find the inches I'd grown. You seemed a foreigner to me, some sweet dignitary returning from holiday, all dressed to the nines. But you were my mama, hair slicked back, a long tight skirt that skimmed the narrow in your hips, and always a lipstick-stained cigarette. In my best red dress and my black patent leathers, my hair pressed and curled, I received you with belly round hugs dressed like Sunday school. I breathed in your perfume, traded my Mary Janes for your high-heeled pumps, painted my lips with your ruby red and tangerine. We played house under the stare of Granny's eye, kissed on the lips, held hands like we thought mothers and daughters should, but neither of us knew for sure. These were the days of our beginnings when mothering and daughtering was bright and brand new. And when you left, I love you so good, you would say. Your hugs were tight, so tight they took my breath away. I clung to you in those times, hoping I could grow heavy in your arms like a gift.
Wow, that's such a powerful poem. You know, I think part of the power is that it speaks to complex family relationships and dynamics that always seem to become even more complex this time of year. It's a time of year when everybody wants a perfect family, and of course, nobody really has a perfect family. What was Christmas like growing up with your grandparents?
Well, you know, it was pretty magical as Christmas is for most children in families who practice those traditions. My grandmother, you know, I consider myself kind of old fashioned now because I was grandparent raised. So my grandparents, my grandmother made popcorn and strung the popcorn, and we had gifts, and a lot of it was she would send out Bible verses or little speeches to all the kids in the family, all my first cousins, and we'd have a big church program. But my mother coming in to visit was always a big part of it, and that was always exciting for me. But, you know, of course, I realized as an adult how uncomfortable it was for my grandmother because of my mother's mental illness. She wasn't sure what to expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how have those relationships affected you over the years, and especially, you know, things like family time at Christmas and other holidays?
Well, I think for me, a lot of what I do is the cooking and trying to enter those old traditions in some ways and give honor to the ways that my grandparents and people like them lived in rural Kentucky. There are, of course, you know, uncomfortable moments in my own family, too, and there's been lots of tragedy. I think the last Christmas was hard, and this one will also be hard with families who are taking special precautions for COVID or have suffered losses. You know, I'm thinking now about the families in Western Kentucky who may not have a home to celebrate in or mm-hmm. who have lost family members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is it about the holidays that I guess it seems like we all want to be closer to family and have that nurturing, even though that's often difficult?
I think it's nostalgia. I think that it's the solstice time that people want to come together to to celebrate and honor time-old traditions. For my family, even though we don't necessarily still do it in a traditional way or with the same reasonings as my grandparents, I think the harvest celebration or Thanksgiving and Christmas are important times to come together and to remember and to look back and you know, it's part of ritual, which I think is innate in us, mm-hmm. in us all. So I think those times are part of sort of ritualistic gatherings to celebrate.
Yeah, and you mentioned food, and I know you're quite a cook, and food is very important to you, and you're working on a book about that.
Yes, I'm working on a culinary memoir that includes a lot of my grandmother's recipes called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost that'll come out in 2023.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your favorite Christmas time treats that she would make or that you make since then?
Well, I didn't like it when I was a child, but I have fond memories of jam cake, which I did like in my young adult years. And I still try to cook one at least a year, just sort of trying to replicate. No one likes it but me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, my family doesn't like it either. My family or my sort of extended family that came along with when I married Ron, like everybody's like, what is that? But for me, it says Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, like some people like the other cake, the fruit cakes,
yeah.
jam cake for our family. And my grandmother taught me to make the jam. So don't really have fresh berries anymore, but I go get frozen blackberries and make the blackberry jam and then make the cake.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you let the cake sit for a long time? Because when my mother makes jam cake, the longer it kind of sits and the better it is.
Yeah, all the flavors meld. I always make a caramel icing for the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds delicious. Well, what advice do you have for families that are kind of, especially this year with COVID and other things, you know, people who have political differences, you know, how do you kind of negotiate family time in such really complicated situations?
Well, I think it is difficult, but I think that, you know, if you can sort of get in where you fit in, and that sounds kind of flip, but I think that have to sort of start new traditions. If you can't sort of insert yourself into the old ones, and I think it's a time to be peaceful and meditate on how things were, and sort of draw nostalgia in and gather those memories. Of course, I'm a writer, so I'm going to say write some of those memories down. I know one year that's a gift that I gave my whole family was I wrote a little bit of something down and gave all my extended family a photograph of my grandparents, and that was all I did that year. So I think that celebrations can be held, you know, in a myriad of ways without, you know, going to the store and coming out the other side broke. I think a lot of it should be about family and traditions, and sometimes you just have to meet people where they are. I think there is a time for fighting too, and making your point known. But I think in addition to that, sort of choosing your battles and sort of meeting people where they are is a big part of getting through those holidays.
Yeah, well, that's great advice. Well, thank you for being with us today. This was Crystal Wilkinson, Kentucky's Poet Laureate, and she was reading a poem, The Visit. And that poem and many other wonderful poems are in her new book, Perfect Black, which was recently published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thanks again, Crystal.
All right, thank you.
The son of a Louisville author, he was 10 at the time, asked his mom why there weren't more books with black characters that look like him. So the author decided to write one, and it's a Christmas book called In the Nick of Time. Arts reporter Stephanie Wolf with member station WFPL has more.
Dee Dee Cummings says she wrote In the Nick of Time because, quote, Black people love Christmas too.
It's very important for children to see themselves in these stories. It validates their experience.
The protagonist in her book is Nick Saint, a young Black boy who gets a letter intended for Saint Nick. The letter writer asks Santa for a job for his mom because his family has nowhere to live. Young Nick is stunned to see another kid asking for something like that, and thus unfolds a story about compassion and gratitude and what Christmas is really about. Cummings says her son has many privileges, and she wanted him to be aware that not everyone has the luxury to ask Santa for something like an Xbox.
I do have a Black character as the lead character, but I can't emphasize enough how books that highlight Black characters are still written for all of us.
She says Nick loves the book. She included this comment from him within the first few pages.
He said, "I love this book because it makes me feel like Christmas, and I like feeling like Christmas."
And spoiler alert, Nick Saint lives up to his name. I'm Stephanie Wolf in Louisville.
We'll be back in just a moment with more stories of the season, including Thomas Wyatt on the nature of the season.
There's this kind of cultural sense of what it means to be American is tied to consuming things. And so Christmas gets very much tied into that concept as well.
Richard Taylor on something missing these days.
I don't even see mistletoe much for sale these days.
Georgia Green Stamper from her short story, Shepherds in Bathrobes.
When I was a child, I thought the three wise men and the shepherds really had worn bathrobes and black socks when they came to adore the Christ child.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, Josephine Sculpture Park in Frankfort will present its Night Sky Tour, 7 to 9 p.m. January 8th at the park. Explore the night sky amid the beautiful Josephine Sculpture Park artwork. For ticket information, visit josephinesculpturepark.org or call 502-352-7082. And the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning's Kentucky Black Writers Collaborative will host the January Black and Lit Book Club, 6 p.m. January 11th on Zoom. The event is free, but registration is required. Club meetings feature new books by Black Kentucky writers. The meeting is open to anyone, not just members of the collaborative. For more information, visit carnegiecenterlex.org/events. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Welcome back to this special Christmas season edition of Eastern Standard. Rooting around our archives, I came across this interview from 2019 that remains as relevant today as it was 2 years ago. Thomas Wyatt is researching and exploring how the modern American Christmas is an artifact of the Cold War. And part of his work looks at the impact of this in Appalachian communities. Given the season, we thought it would be interesting to hear what he has learned so far. Dr. Wyatt joins us from Spearfish, South Dakota, where he is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University. Greetings, Dr. Wyatt.
Hello.
So tell us more about the premise of this work. How is the modern American Christmas an artifact of the Cold War standoff between the U.S. and the former USSR?
When I first started thinking about this project, I was thinking about how Christmas is celebrated in 21st century America, and thinking about kind of connecting back to where do we get some of these ideas from. Now, the idea of kind of a commercialized Christmas is not a new concept, right? Charles Dickens wrote about it in 1843, but this notion of the tension between secular and sacred, which is really kind of part of the modern Christmas interpretation, you see this in the Cold War because there's a promotion of commercial ideas, while at the same time a promotion of kind of quasi-religious ideas, all within this context of the conflict with the Soviet Union, presenting and promoting what it means to be American, is tied very much to ideas about democratic capitalism. And so through government actions and the actions of private entities, we see the promotion of this notion of consumerism and consumption as part of the Christmas holiday.
Okay, and so our understanding of this holiday, the religious aspect of it aside, kind of evolves out of America's propaganda war with the Soviet Union.
It does, on some levels, in terms of trying to promote this idea of what is the good life, what is the American dream, right? In the 1950s and the early 1960s, there is this strong emphasis on this notion of suburban white America living in, you know, Cape Cod ranch houses as far as the eye can see, buying things and making kind of a material world of comfort. And that's promoted both by government action, but also by private entities and especially through the projected images of television. And so there's this kind of cultural sense of what it means to be American is tied to consuming things. And so Christmas gets very much tied into that concept as well.
When you looked at what was going on in media and primarily television back in those days, back in the 60s, let's say, what did you find? How did you connect the dots there?
I think television is a great way of thinking about how ideals are promoted and projected across time and space. So the prescriptive kind of 1950s sitcoms and things like that. But what really caught my attention were the 60s television Christmas specials, the ones that we all kind of, basically every December, it seems everyone kind of trots these out and watches them, right? The Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Charlie Brown Christmas and Santa Claus is Coming to Town, all of those. And what struck me at one point when I was working on my doctorate, I watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So it was Christmas time, so I'll watch this. And when my brain shut off and I started watching it, and all these thoughts just start coming into my head about kind of what is actually happening in this special. And it was created in 1964, and it's talking about notions of acceptance and nonconformity and, you know, kind of seeing it as an allegory for racial integration in the 1960s. And a lot of different things all happening at once. And I was sitting there, I was talking about all these ideas until someone threw a pillow at me and told me to be quiet because I was ruining their Christmas. And it's true. I mean, you start doing this and you lose track of, oops, maybe I've ruined someone's childhood. But the more I kind of watch these shows, different ideas started popping out at kind of different points between Rudolph and Charlie Brown Christmas. I mean, that one's much more about kind of the secular sacred divide. And Santa Claus is Coming to Town with the Meisterburger, who kind of looks kind of Nixonian. Santa Claus as maybe a hippie. So it's just such an interesting set of ideas and kind of promoting or projecting cultural values of this period from 1964 to 1970 through these specials that we largely forget as we watch them in a more nostalgic way, but they really are artifacts of that moment when they were created.
Well, you have investigated how the promotion of Christmas in these more secular, commercialized terms or contexts had impacts on Appalachian communities. What have you found there?
Well, what's really interesting, when I was starting some of this research, I came across a CBS report from 1965 with Charles Kuralt called Christmas in Appalachia. It was a half-hour special or so, and I sat down and watched this. And one thing that Kuralt kind of kept coming back to over and over again was this notion of Christmas as connected to consuming things, right? He, at one point, asks a laid-off miner, you know, are the kids going to have a Christmas this year? Well, logically speaking, of course they will, right? They're Christian, you know, this Christian family, they will celebrate Christmas, but that's not what Kuralt is asking. He's asking, are they going to get presents this year? And that kind of connectivity of just being able to say, are they going to have a Christmas this year? With the implication, are they going to get presents by 1965 when this special comes out? Like, that's just understood. And so during this special, Kuralt asks this miner this. He hasn't worked in, I think it was 10 months. And he says, well, what I'm going to do is we're going to have, you know, try to be happy that day, but I don't have anything to give them. And he's really kind of upset about that. And so you can see in that report kind of this notion of Christmas and consumption is very much tied together.
Where are you with this research now? What are you still exploring?
Oh, I'm still kind of early in this. I want to keep digging in on Appalachia and questions about how poverty, in particular in Appalachia, and notions of Appalachia being somehow different, how that affected, you know, its connection with Christmas and those types of things. I'm looking to expand a little bit more on the sights and sounds of Christmas in the Cold War. So moving beyond those Christmas specials to really pull in things like music, advertising, and thinking about who else gets left out of Christmas and what it means to be an American when those two things get tied together in this kind of consumer nature. So the poor or other communities that don't actually celebrate Christmas, can they now start to celebrate a more secular, nationalized Christmas and thereby maybe come closer into acceptance in the wider American community? So there's a lot of different ideas and a lot of things to kind of reach towards.
Dr. Thomas Wyatt is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University in Spearfish, South Dakota. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Christmas shoppers shopping on a neon city street. Another Christmas dollar for another Christmas treat. They're satin on the pretty dolls that make the children glow, while a boy is walking ragged in the cold Kentucky snow. No, they don't have Christmas in Kentucky. There's no holly on
the... Mistletoe can be very much a part of the greenery that symbolizes and decorates the Christmas holiday, not to mention its special place in history. The tradition of kissing under the mistletoe started in ancient Greece during the festival of Saturnalia and later in marriage ceremonies because of the plant's association with fertility. During the Roman era, enemies at war would reconcile their differences under the mistletoe, which to them represented peace. In our lifetimes, couples who find themselves standing beneath the plant suspended upside down from a doorway are supposed to kiss, leading to a great deal of hopeful, sometimes skillful, often clumsy, maneuvering at holiday gatherings. And as Tom Eblin hears in our next conversation with an author from the Kentucky Christmas Anthology, it has to be the toughest to harvest.
Richard Taylor is a former Kentucky Poet Laureate and a longtime professor at Kentucky State and Transylvania Universities. He has written extensively about Kentucky history. But for the book, A Kentucky Christmas, he dipped into his personal history to write about mistletoe, the parasitic plant that grows high in old Kentucky trees and is popular this time of year as an encouragement for kissing. Richard, thanks for being with us today.
Happy to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Well, first of all, tell us a little about what really is mistletoe and what's its history with the holidays and kissing and all that.
Mistletoe is a parasitic plant, green with sort of pearly berries on it that you can spot along almost any Kentucky tree line. The origins of the folkloristic side of and religious side of mistletoe date back to Northern Europe, especially England. The name itself, mistletoe, means dung and tan. Tan was apparently an Anglo-Saxon word for twig, and it commemorated a popular belief that this plant sprung from the dung of birds that ate the berries and then perched in the host tree. Like many of our other Christmas traditions, mistletoe, because it was green, because it was ever green, took its place with Christmas trees and Christmas wreaths as part of pagan ceremonies among Scandinavians, the Vikings, the Danes, and Anglo-Saxons and others. It took its place and was adopted by Christianity when Western Europe was Christianized. And so it's become very much a part of traditions in this country. And it was one that was revered by my father, as this story relates. And I can remember that every year, early in December, he would go to his sort of country origins in eastern Jefferson County around the little community of Worthington. And he knew a lot of people there for a lifetime. He did legal work for some of them. And he would spot a tree with mistletoe in it. And instead of shooting it down, he much preferred to climb the tree. And this story is about an incident when he and my neighbor, Mr. Murky, that Murky's a really interesting name. It's German, probably something like Merke in German. At any rate, he and Mr. Murky, both in their 60s, set out in my father's Jeep one December and went about 10 or 12 miles east of Louisville to a farm in Worthington. And what made this trip different was that it was snowing and sleeting and intensely cold, and it was a kind of wet snowfall, which slickened the ground and should have put them both on notice that my father had no business climbing trees. At any rate, he was pretty set in his ways and pretty determined to bring home some jumbo-sized portions of mistletoe. So he shinnied up this tree and he started sawing and lowering down with by means of a trot line these enormous clumps, which Mr. Murky would place in the Jeep. Well, before long, he realized that he himself was going to have to come down. He was in the middle of a blizzard. And he found that his hands were too cold, really, to grip the tree. And Mr. Murky, who was frustrated as he was, suggested that he place his hands inside his shirt against his belly to see if he could restore the circulation. And apparently that worked, because by the hardest, he was able to come down the tree. And the two of them, remember, they were both in their 60s at this point. They weren't spring chickens. Managed to get this mistletoe into the Jeep and themselves into the Jeep. And they bounced across the pasture and drove toward town. And Mr. Murky, it was no secret in our neighborhood, liked to drink. And there was a famous sort of a landmark for over 100 years restaurant and bar called Bowers. It had a sign outside that said Bowers since 1870. And I can remember my father telling me stories about his father, who was a farmer, taking produce into the Haymarket region, the market region of Louisville, by horse and wagon and stopping at Bowers. So Mr. Murky saw the sign, they pulled in and said, "Buzz," which was his nickname, "Buzz, let's go in and have just one drink." And they went into this bar, which was kind of, by that time, kind of it was a little more formal than many places in the area. It was known for its food and as well as its drinks. So they went into this bar, and you can imagine they looked, both of them, pretty scruffy. And they ordered a double shot of Old Granddad. I know these details because I taped Mr. Murky in about 1974, just after my father had died. At any rate, that alcohol apparently was restorative, though it produced a kind of false sense of heat and neural warmth. And the two of them made it home, and they had a Christmas memory which has been passed down in my family for a long while. In a way, it sort of characterized my father, who in many ways was headstrong, determined. He would share this mistletoe with others, not just Mr. Murky, but other people in the neighborhood. And so when Georgella asked a number of us to make submissions, this story came to mind, and I thought to put it down on paper.
Yeah, well, it's a really great story. I'm curious, do you go out hunting mistletoe?
I don't. I hunt it with my eyes. I see it all the time. I've seen some today. I've got it growing in some trees on my small farm. I don't even see mistletoe much for sale these days. I think it may be one of those traditions that's like the heater in his Jeep, sort of anemic. It doesn't seem to be a growing tradition.
Yeah, well, I guess it's hard to either climb or go out there with a rifle and shoot them, too, because you've got to be a pretty good shot with a .22 to bring down much mistletoe.
Right.
Yeah. What really struck me about this story was how many family memories we really make and how often those are built around the holidays. Why do you think that is?
Well, of course, it's a kind of homecoming. Even those of us who are working slacken off a little bit during the holidays. And I see winter and the holidays as a time for reflection and a time to appreciate the lives we are blessed to live among our families. I know in my case, my brother every year hosts a Christmas dinner, which brings together probably more tailors than you'd want to encounter before dark or after dark in any one place, usually about 30 or so of us. And they come from, you know, as far away as Nashville. And it's just a great sort of family reunion. And the same is true at Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
It gives us an opportunity to sit down and pause a moment in our lives, which are all too often frenetic and unreflective. And it gives us a chance to ask ourselves, what is it that's really important? And I think most of us would answer that finally, family is incredibly important, especially as we watch the generations change, and especially with children who retain a lot of that sense of wonder and excitement. Perhaps some of us who are older have lost or have only in diminished quantities.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, do your kids have any great Christmas stories about you?
I think they do, and I'm not sure that many of them could be repeated on the radio, but there are a lot of stories and associations that all of us have about Christmas, and I hope in some way this discussion prompts some of those memories in your listeners.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to, Tom.
Richard Taylor, former poet laureate of Kentucky.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
There's a very good reason why the holiday season is a wonderful time for a boy and girl to fall in love. 'Cause Santa and Cupid planned exactly what you did when you kissed me by the mistletoe above. We stood there kissing by the mistletoe. Tingle, tingle,
tingle,
tingle. And away we go. Jingle, jingle.
We save for last a request of Georgia Green Stamper to sit down with us and tell us her story of shepherds in bathrobes, straight from the pages of Kentucky Monthly's Kentucky's 12 Days of Christmas. She readily agreed.
When I was a child, I thought the three wise men and the shepherds really had worn bathrobes and black socks when they came to adore the Christ child. This was the way they were always dressed in the Christmas pageant at our church, and I assumed the costuming was historically accurate. I wasn't quite sure While biblical men had wrapped terry cloth towels around their heads, but since Christmas is often cold in Kentucky, I figured they probably wanted to keep their bald heads warm. Our tiny Methodist church thought big, and we staged an elaborate reenactment of the Christmas story every year, although the director made an annual announcement that she would never do this again. To pull this off, everyone in the congregation was drafted into service. Even the youngest served as stable animals, and the most elderly turned the light switches on and off at critical moments. Were it not for the kindness of the Baptists across the road, we would have played to empty pews. We cast them as the audience, and they obliged by dismissing their Sunday night service to help us out. I can still recall the angels' wings. They were shaped out of baling wire from the hayfield, and then were covered from span to span with multiple layers of ivory crepe paper. A creative, genial woman who died much too young tediously shaped the overlapping layers of fragile paper into thousands of feather-like ruffles. The wings were magnificent, and I'm pretty sure God added Margaret Carr's design to his pattern book. Our choir of angels who sang on high was small, but their voices were fine and pure and covered every part. Mr. and Mrs. Bell could not be equaled at bass and alto. Cousin May hit the soprano notes with the skill of a trained opera singer. And Bill, who later became a Baptist but got his start in the Methodist choir, sang a fine tenor. And his future wife, Faye, handled the keyboard with skill. There were a few other angels, too, even me. But mostly, we only hummed. Mrs. Prather was a perennial director, and in real life, she was a fifth-grade schoolteacher accustomed to being obeyed. Every year, about halfway through the month of rehearsals, she would have a mild breakdown, alternately crying and then yelling because no one was listening to her. Once she spoke sharply to a wise man who'd been hastily recruited to fill a bathrobe from the ranks of loitering boyfriends hanging around the Methodist Youth Fellowship. Now, admittedly, he was flirting when he should have been following yonder star, but he was so taken aback at being reprimanded that he vowed never to darken the door of a church again. I hope he didn't keep that vow. I'd hate to think our Christmas pageant sent him straight to hell. Years later, though, whenever I found myself standing in the midst of pandemonium trying to lead people who did not want to be led, have you ever tried to build gingerbread houses with 20 brownie Girl Scouts in a very tiny room? I would think about Mrs. Prather and carry on for her sake. I wish I'd told her when I could how much the pageants meant to me. One memory in particular remains vivid. Our shepherds were no-nonsense farmers recruited from the adult men's Sunday school class. I can only imagine how their Christian faith was tested when they were asked to don ridiculous-looking bathrobes in public, wrap towels around their heads, and come to play practice every Sunday afternoon. To compound their stage misery, one year Mrs. Prather surprised the shepherds at our first rehearsal by altering the perennial silent tableau. "This Christmas, the shepherds would have lines to recite," she said. Then she instructed the shepherds to move forward one by one and read their assigned paragraphs. When shepherd number two was called upon, he gamely stepped up. He read the first word, "the," but then stopped. He looked at the floor. He cleared his throat. And in an instant, I understood. Shepherd number two could not read, at least not well. He was one of the most honorable, pleasant men I've ever met, hardworking and capable. I'm sure that in today's schools, he would have been diagnosed with dyslexia or some other synapse glitch that made reading more difficult for him than for others. But in that awful moment, he stood mute on the altar of the church. That's when the good thing happened. Without a look passing between them, the other shepherds began to read the lines for him. Their tongues turned to silver, and then they seamlessly moved on to their own. The wise men joined in, too. I've never heard a choral reading more deftly executed. The powerful rhythm of their conjoined voices erased all embarrassment. And we went on to have the best rehearsal we ever had. By the next Sunday, Shepherd number two had memorized his lines, and the incident was never spoken of. And so it came to pass that I learned the true meaning of Christmas from farmers wearing bathrobes with towels on their heads. Whenever I find myself uncertain of my performance in life, I think about those good men, unsure of themselves too, but unafraid to look ridiculous in the trying.
Georgia Green Stamper reading Shepherds in Bathrobes, her contribution to the anthology Kentucky's 12 Days of Christmas. From all of us here at WEKU, have a merry, happy, and safe Christmas. We're taking next week off to prepare for the new year, and we'll be back in your ears on the 6th of January, 2022. And that wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Music in this edition includes Kentucky's Heath and Molly with the Phil Ochs song, No Christmas in Kentucky, and Aretha Franklin's Kissin' by the Mistletoe. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org. on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.